Accession number 20983, Reel 3.
Jim Campbell, Reel 3.
Yes, now at that time I was talking to my platoon commander and he'd ordered me down to the Kazakh clearing station, and I had a little bit of an argument with him, and I said, it's no place to go, they were dead and dying down there by the score. And I looked at him and his injuries were much the same as me because he'd been hit as well. I said, I'll tell you what, sir, when you go down there, I'll go with you. And he said, I looked at me and he said, right, Corporal, he says, go and rest, he says, and come and see me when you feel better. I guess I was in a state of shock. So I found a nice corner in a barn somewhere with a nice dry straw, and I think I must have slept for about 24 hours. But when I wakened up, I felt much better, and I went to report to the platoon commander, and he had a good look at me. By this time, I'd had my wounds cleaned up, and I felt a lot better. And although I couldn't see very well out my left eye, I said, I don't want to be evacuated. I said, I want to stay. I wasn't being a hero. I just felt it was my duty. So he allowed me to stay. And right, the platoon commander sent me off to find a rest area, and I found a place in a barn with nice clean straw. And after about 24 hours sleep, I felt much better. I reported back to him, and he said, well done, Corporal. He said, are you fit? I said, fit enough, sir. He said, you capable of taking over a gun of your own? And I said, I am, sir. So he then formed a new gun team for me. I knew them all, so I didn't have any difficulty settling down with them because we'd done all our training together. But at this point, I'd like to recap a wee bit. During our briefing prior to the action, although they told us what our objective was and what we had in support and a sort of broad picture of what the battle's going to be, one of the things I forgot is who we were going to fight. And it turned out it was Hitler's crack troops were up against. In other words, it was a Hitler youth. These were fanatics. The youngest one would be about 17 years of age, much the same age as myself. And believe you me, they were fanatical. They waited until you were about 10 yards from them before they would stop firing, and then they put their hands up and they expected to take them prisoner. But again, as I say once more, just one of these things. But towards the end of that first action, we were told that there were the elements of six different divisions in front of us. And it was then that various people came to congratulate us, like the divisional commander, the army commander came around as well, I believe, and the corps commander, General O'Connor, and told us how well we'd done. And of the three divisions, we'd suffered 4,500 casualties in that week, and 2,500 had been suffered by 15 Scottish division. So we'd seen more or less more of our share of the battle. And the battalion itself, with over 200 casualties, and particularly among the officers and NCOs, was a tremendous loss. So we're out of action for about a fortnight, getting re-equipped, and then we started getting reinforcements sent to us. Now, when I joined the battalion, I was surprised at the number of English people that was in the battalion, especially around the Lancashire area and Yorkshire area, and quite a lot of Londoners. But the reinforcement that came to us, the first draft was from the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. I believe there was 80 of them. So we first up calling ourselves the Ox and Jocks, for the want of a better name. But we soon settled them down and fitted them into regiments and got them bomb models, and they were quite happy to be called the Ox and Jocks. And to be honest with you, they turned out to be absolutely excellent troops. Now, after about a fortnight out of line, we'd heard that things were pretty static, and we were going to have another go at them. This time, we're going to attack to the right of Hill 112. So we're back up the same road, up through Gavru, up to Barong, which is the next village up. Then we deployed. The Gordons in front, they were to make the initial attack, followed by the Highland Light Infantry and myself. Now, that night, although we're half a mile behind the front line, we know the Gordons put in four attacks that that night, and four times they were driven back. Then we started getting mortared and shelled, and it was pretty grim, I don't mind telling you, as bad as Gavru. And during the course of the night, we had over 100 casualties in the battalion. As I say again, half a mile behind the lines. Now, one of the casualties that we suffered there was our own Brigadier McIntosh Walker, a fine officer who had been with us from the time that the brigade had formed up, and he was killed at his command post at Barong. And I'll say again, it was a big loss. The next thing we heard was that Brigadier Colville, or Colonel Colville of the Gordon Highlanders, was taken over as Brigadier. Then we're told that because of the situation, we're pulling us back out again, that attack had failed. Now, we didn't like it at all. We didn't like being losers. And it's the only time ever that we had to be pulled out. But again, we suffered so many casualties that it was just a pointless going any further. So we pulled out, and about a week later, we were told to stand by for another move. And they then moved us up into the American sector. And we took over from, I believe it was the 11th Battalion of the 111th American Regiment. Now, these chaps had landed in D-Day, and they'd been in the same position from D-Day, and this was now coming up to the beginning of August. So when they pulled out, they left us all their dugouts, which was very, very comfortable, having been there for 6 weeks. A tremendous supply of cigarettes and chocolates and American rations, which made a change from our compo, which we've been living on, and our hard army biscuits. So again, we got a tremendous briefing for this. And we're told that the tank support this time would be old friends of ours who had done a tremendous amount of training with in Yorkshire, the 6th Independent Guards Brigade. Now, you can imagine guardsmen, five of them all squeezed into a Churchill tank. They must have been pretty cramped. There was the Scots Guards, Coldstream Guards, and Grenadier Guards. I can't remember the battalions actually involved, but they were tremendous tank crews, I don't mind telling you. And we're very, very happy to have them with us. So when we did start off again with a tremendous barrage of artillery, and this time we had some tremendous close support from the Royal Air Force, bombers and fighter bombers. And it was nice to see these Typhoons and Spitfires circling above us. It gave us a tremendous amount of confidence because we knew quite well there wouldn't be a German vehicle moved as long as they were up there. Now that day, we, ourselves as infantry, marched for 14 miles cross country. We fought our way through three very strong German strong points. We'd taken quite a number of prisoners. And then that night, the tanks radioed back to say they were 30 miles inside German lines and there wasn't a German to be seen. Unfortunately, that morning, and it was unfortunate, it was a rather sad story, one of the chaps had left, had joined up with me, a little fella called George Martin. When he heard that I was a regular soldier, he had changed his engagement from duration of emergency, as they called it these days, or the duration of war, to become a regular soldier. And he came up to the Orkneys with me and went down to, did all our training together. He went to D Company, I stayed with Support Company. Now that morning, D Company passed through us to start their attack. And I saw the company disappearing through this hedge into a field. And the next minute it was an explosion. And stretcher bearers went rushing through there and brought George Martin back. Now George, I recognised the stretcher, but only just, he'd lost his right leg. His right arm, I didn't think he would save it, all up his right side and his right face, as well as his right eye. And I was ever so sorry because, as I say again, he's a very, very close friend of mine. At the same time, they brought out the company sergeant major. He had lost a foot on a shoe mine. So we knew then that we were really running into a real defended position. However, there were quite a few casualties that day from mines. But on the whole, very little other casualties from rifle and machine gun fire, and mortar fire and artillery fire was at minimum. However, that night when we stopped at our defending position, the Scots Guards, who had sort of ring of tanks round us, were just settling down when the next thing we heard a battle in front of us just over the crest of a hill. And it turned out there was two German, one a tank and one a mobile artillery, had opened fire in these Churchill tanks and knocked out 10 tanks. Fortunately, the crews were out the tanks and there was only manned by one person in the turret, so their casualties were quite light, but they did lose 10 tanks. By the time we were sent up, there were 6 pounders. We were told, you know, these tanks had disappeared, they'd gone. So rather sad ending to the day. First of all, it's losing George Martin in the morning, and then seeing these 10 tanks in fire at night time, which was, what's the word for it? Really sad. However, the next day it went on and on and on, and we finished up at a place called the Vassy Road. Again, we're under intense machine gun and artillery fire from tanks. Although we didn't see the tanks ourselves looking hard enough for, we heard there were quite an action off to our left where our 25 pounders were firing over open sights at 4 German tanks that appeared. So we fought our way up this road, and at the end of the day, again, as always happens, late in the afternoon, a company commander called Alan Fife put in an attack on our, just a little copse. I said, "Well, clear that one," he says, "and then it'll secure the line." And as they moved across the open ground towards this cop, the Germans opened fire on them. And I believe they suffered, it was either 26 or 28 killed or wounded. So they lay out there in the open until a Major Morton, who's our company commander at one time, he now had a rifle company, went out with a flag. And although he was fired at, he made contact with the Germans, and we called an armistice, and we sent out our stretcher bearers and various people to bring our casualties in, including Major Fife, who had been killed. So, as I say once again, it always seems to happen late in the day, somebody gets killed that you know extremely well. So we held on there for about 2 days, and although with little incidents like a German armoured car or a half-track come driving through our lines in the morning full of tea and coffee, they had no idea where their own troops were, so we captured that. Coffee was awful. It was even worse than our tea. However, we'd taken 3 prisoners there, and again, stragglers started coming in, all sorts of nationalities, particularly Russians. So the line was static, more or less, and we're told then that the Americans had put in their big attack around St. Lo. Down, I think it was Sarntan they called it, and they were wheeling left to come round behind the Germans heading towards Paris and to cut the Germans off at Falaise Gap. Now that virtually ended our sort of attack there, although again we lost a tremendous number of good people in there. We had about, oh, I think there were about 30 killed in the 3 days fighting and about 100 wounded. So again, we were pulled back into a rest area. Unfortunately, the rest area we were in that night got bombed. I think it was three German bombers come over, and we lost 7 that were in Water Platoon killed, who were all close friends of mine. And again, we lost Captain Sloan, who is a mortar officer. He was killed as well. Major Kenneth, who was standing in for the commanding officer, who had to go back for a small operation. He was very badly wounded. I believe he lost his right leg and fingers of his right hand. So all in all, it was a most unsatisfactory end to that particular action. So we're then left in limbo for about 4 days. And although we're told we're going to take part in an attack at Falaise, it didn't come to anything. I think we're in too poor a state. We'd suffered too many casualties to have any use to anybody. So again, it's a case of just waiting there to be reinforced and re-equipped. However, a very funny incident happened. There was a major arrival in Mids called Major Ferguson, and it turned out that he had escaped, we may call it, from the holding drafting unit, and he'd been marked absent without leave. He'd been posted to another unit, but when he heard that Giles had so many casualties, he thought it was his duty to report to their Giles. So before we knew where he was, he was here and he'd gone, and then we heard the story that he'd been ordered back and he was in serious trouble apparently, but it all turned out in the end because I met him after the war. It turned out he was a brother of the great Sir Bernard Ferguson, who was a Chindit leader. So that was another story. But prior to that, I would like to mention this one. we did see the 1,000 bomber raid on Cannes and Kapiki airfield, and this is after our first action. And we actually saw a 1,000 bomber raid going in. There were only about, I doubt very much if they're 1,000 foot up. Streams of bombers coming in, controlled by a little aircraft called an Oster. And this chap was just more or less circled round there in a very tight circle, directed these streams of bombers in on different targets. So it was, you know, wonderful sight to see. We were more or less level with the height of the aircraft where they were bombing from. We were on a bit of a high ground. Unfortunately, when the Canadians moved forward to capture the airfield, the Germans had been underground, and up they came. And we could actually see these Canadians being slaughtered. Dozens of them were getting shot down. Although they'd be about a mile away, you know, you could still see them through binoculars. So that was the sort of end of the Battle of Normandy as far as we were concerned. But I thought I'd throw that one in, although it happened about first week in July, I believe, when the Canadians took Kapiki finally. But there's quite a battle for that airfield. So that more or less is our Battle of Normandy until we come up to Falaise. Now, we're told then that there was a big rush on to get up to the Seine. However, when we reached Falaise itself, it was the most horrendous experience of the war so far, with quite a number of them. We had 7 miles of road, and on both sides of that road, there were a mixture of horses and men. The smell was dreadful. And they called this a great victory for the Royal Air Force. Well, it showed us just what air power could do. There was guns, there was vehicles of all description, but it was then that we learned that most of the German army, well, I reckon at that time, about 80% of it moved with horse transport. We couldn't believe it until we saw the number of dead horses in that field, or these fields. It was 7 miles of it, and it took us all day moving up behind bulldozers. They were trying to clear the road in front of us to get us through, and believe you me, when we get through that valley gap, we were relieved people. The smell lives with me even now. You can smell it. And they tell me that the road further to the south was even worse. It was, well, it was indescribable, the scenes that we saw there. Anyway, having got through that, we then, big purge, the roads were clear, they were pretty straight right up to the Seine, and I believe we made the Seine in one day, and having got up to it, I think it was mid-morning, there was a very, very quick old group, and they decided there'd be no preparation, that they would bounce the Seine that day. Well, the Argylls, again, we were tail-end Charlie sort of style, so we were told to load our vehicles with canvas boats, assault boats, and we were what we call bearer party, if you like, for want of a better word, and we moved the boats up and handed them over to the Highland Light Infantry on the right, a bigger part of the Gordons on the right, and the Highland Light Infantry on the left, helped them to get the boats into the water for them to do the assault. Unfortunately, the Gordons, they ran into machine gun fire and they lost two of their boats and they had quite a number of casualties. So they pulled them back very, very quickly under fire and under a smoke screen. And we concentrated on the Highland Light Infantry side. So they had a very successful landing. And having followed them up, we then deployed another side. We took a place called St. Andelys, which was a big chateau. Unfortunately, again, we ran into pockets of Germans, and I lost a Lance Corporal at that time from a German. I think this Lance Corporal had waken him up. He was lying about my slit trench and shot this Lance Corporal. So we finished up throwing grenades into this hole and killed him. So we're always very wary of what we were doing, you know, with these odd people that was around. There were still these fanatics that didn't know the war was virtually finished. We then took a town called Louvers, and what a welcome we got there. It's the first time we'd actually seen any French people, apart from that family that I'd liberated at Tourville. This is the first time we'd actually seen a French village with any population in it at all, and the welcome they gave us was wonderful. The wine appeared, and the brandy appeared, and the fruit appeared, and they gave us everything that they virtually had, although they were starving themselves. And they told us that the Germans just pulled out about an hour before. So having occupied the town, we then sorted it out and we got ourselves moving again, filled up with petrol and checked for ammunition. And by this time, they'd had bridges built across the river, and there were streams of armoured vehicles pouring across, tanks of all sorts of description. And this is the time when I saw the, I believe it was either Covenant or the Cromwell, which is a new cruiser tank with a 17-pounder gun mounted on it. Although we had were M10s, which was supports they'd an open turreted vehicle with a 17-pounder mounted on it, which could take on these German 88s. So all in all, the moor was moving extremely well. So after sort of doing wood clearing around the place and getting myself established, we then moved across the north of France, and it was just one great big race. And we're doing 110 to 120 mile a day to a little town called St. Paul. S-T-P-O-L. When we occupied that, this was a railroad junction just south of Calais, I believe. So again, it gave us time to get ourselves sorted out, got myself vehicles filled up with petrol, checked all our tracks, and off we went, racing up into Belgium. So although we got a tremendous reception from the French people, when we got into Belgium, it was even better. The roads were straight, everybody was out on the roadside. There wasn't a German in sight, there was no firing. And we moved right up through various villages till we came to a place called Mall, M-O-L-L. And there we stopped. The recce went out, the recce regiment, and they come back and said, you know, that the bridges were still up over the Escott Giel Canal. It was called the Junction Canal, which we were to take. So having done recces, we were then told to take the canal. So the 44 Brigade went over first, Royal Scots and Royal Scots Fusiliers, and they had quite a battle to take a little town called Donk, D-O-N-K. Now, they held on there for about 10 days, and we were on this bank on this side, and we could hear and see everything that was going on, until it was our turn to cross. Now, it was us and the Gordons went over much the same time, and the road was straight up through this village, and at the other end of the road was either a German tank or the fighting vehicle of some description, firing an 88 down the road. And from the time he fired, the time the shell exploded, you had 2 seconds to find cover. Well, all the way up that road, there was all sorts of bodies, British and German. And as we moved up the left-hand side of the road, so the Royal Scots Fusiliers was moving down the left. So eventually we got into the positions we're going to be, and I found myself to the right of the church, manning a 6-pounder which had been left by the Royal Scots Fusiliers. So we checked around to see what was in front of us, and we were just enough sort of daylight to have a look. Got myself into position and settled down for the night, sorted out who was going to do the first watches, and that was us stuck in there for 10 days. Now, every day was packed with incidents. We got attacked in the morning, we got attacked at lunchtime, we got attacked at night time. And as we moved in that day, well, they say it was the same day, but I think it was the day after, 17th September, we saw the airborne invasion of Nijmegen, Arnhem and Eindhoven. They all more or less virtually flew right over the top of us. That was quite a sight, I don't mind telling you. And then we got told what was happening, that they were taking these bridges. Now, on the way in, there was very little ACAC fire because there were so many Spitfires and American fighters buzzing around these aircraft above and alongside them. But on the way out, I saw 6 Dakotas getting shot down. It was awful to watch. They had no chance, these people. They're only flying about 1,000 feet, and one after the other. So goodness knows how many aircraft. We wouldn't lose them going in, but we certainly lost them going out. So again, we were stuck there. Now, the object of the exercise was for the 15th Scottish Division to go in there and hold a bridgehead as though we're trying to attack Antwerp. Now, that was the broader picture of whether we needed a port to get our supplies in, because by this time, the supplies were way back in Normandy, along with that thing called Pluto, pipelined under the ocean, they called it, to bring more petrol across. All our ammunition and food supplies had to come up by road. So the Germans thought this was what the plan was, although with the invasion of the airborne invasion, there was also an infantry attack on Antwerp. But it wasn't a case of that at all. It was to bring down the reinforcements from North Holland and Denmark down into Belgium to take the pressure off the airborne forces. And believe you me, we had quite a scrap there. It lasted for about we were in there for 10 days. It must have been 3 weeks altogether. The division held that bridgehead. It was only 800 yards wide and 500 yards deep at its deepest. We're under constant fire, under constant observation. If you move by day at all, you had to do a sprint. We even got strafed by our own typhoons at one time. We'd fired smoke, which was red smoke, but by the time the aircraft got over the target, the smoke had drifted back over us. They came down and strafed us and caused quite a number of casualties. However, there was always somebody brave, and it was Ian McCall, a lieutenant, and a Sergeant Duffin ran out with our yellow smoke recognition grenades, waving at these aircraft to try and get them to stop, which they eventually did. But during the time we were in that bridgehead, even my platoon, with four people killed and goodness knows how many wounded, were just acting as infantry. We weren't anti-tank gunners. We're just as infantry. And as I say once more, it wasn't a very, very nice place to be. And when the word came that we're pulling out that night, we were more than happy to pull out, believe you me. So we eventually made our way back again. And it was the next day we learned that the HLI had sent out the normal patrols, as we always did, only to find that the Germans had pulled out at the same time. So we felt it was such a waste of time, but we were assured by the powers that be, our divisional commander and the various other people who came to us after this action, to tell us how important that our action had been. Because even it came across in the German radio that the crack 15 Scottish Division had crossed the Escott Canal and were attempting to attack Antwerp, and that they were putting up very stubborn resistance. This was given out in the German radio, which we got in our little sort of regimental paper called the Tam O'Shanter, which was a newsletter sent out around all the battalions. So that kept us informed as to what was going on. So then it was a case of racing across Belgium. We took a couple of villages called Mechelen and Deens, stopped there for a little rest. And that night, we again went out in patrols, and we ran into, of all things, a Belgian circus. So we made acquaintance with them, and we swapped our rations for theirs, and it was the first time I'd tasted pickled hern. And it was very tasty, with the German bread, or the ersatz breads they gave us then. So we had a look around and found that the population was absolutely starving. It was the first time I'd seen this, and I think it's worth mentioning that every farm we took, there was not a cow, a goat, a sheep, or a hen to be seen. The Germans had raped these farms of every animal, took them back to Germany, and left the population absolutely starving. So we knew then that we're going to have problems feeding ourselves, never mind the population of Belgium and Holland. And as we moved up into Holland, it got worse. Now, the next time we were on the move, we were told then that we were going to Eindhoven. And this is the time we linked up with American Airborne. And I think we were the first infantry they had seen. They had been there for about, a week or 10 days. And they were only too pleased to see us. And they gave us the news that that's what had happened again. They told us how bad things were up at Arnhem, that the Airborne had been cut off up there. And there were all sorts of rumours, of course. And then we moved up to Son, which was one of the bridges you saw in the film Bridge Too Far. And we took that over from Americans and held that for about 3 or 4 days before they found another role for us. And then we moved up into Holland itself. The first place that we attacked was a village called Best, of all things called B-E-S-T, and there we had a Bata shoe factory, a big cement works, and a railway goods yard, which was very, very heavily defended. The country was flat. They seemed to have all the good positions. They had any high ground at all, they were holding it. So we were overlooked every time we moved at all. However, we eventually sort of gradually, day after day, it was just a grind until such times as we wore them down. Then we took a little village called Vlut, V-L-U-E-T, and what a battle we had for that. It was heathlands, and some of that heath was about head high. And as we moved out, the Germans would just wait until they could see our feet, so they'll open fire on us, a quick burst of a machine gun, and then they would run. Now, unfortunately, in that action, we lost two company commanders in rapid succession. Major Robertson, who was my company commander at one time, in A Company, and I first joined the battalion. And about an hour later, his second-in-command, Captain Shaw, I believe he's a Canadian officer attached to us, he got killed as well. So we're suffering casualties, what we thought unnecessarily, but this had to be cleared. And it was then, day after day, this went on, patrols at night time, making contact with Germans, finding out where they were, sorting them out the next morning.